From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. In California, the COVID-19 numbers are up again this week. At this moment, on the Johns Hopkins data dashboard, California has 99,810 confirmed cases. Hospitalizations in the state are up a bit, and more than 3,800 people have lost their lives. Testing, though, is up too, with more than 50,000 tests done, according to the state, since Sunday. Every day, though, also brings us news about reopenings and changes. Guidelines. So yesterday, Governor Newsom characterized the big picture this way.
We're not even out of the first wave of this pandemic. People are talking about the second wave. That's many, many months off. The reality is this pandemic has just begun. It hasn't ended. And while we are moving forward because of stabilization, because of the good work that's been done by health officials all across this nation, all across the state of California, specifically to suppress the spread of this virus, by no stretch of the imagination is this virus behind us.
On the phone with us now is Dr. Brad Pollack. He is professor and chairman of the Department of Public Health Sciences and associate dean for public health sciences at the UC Davis School of Medicine. He's also chairman of the UC System's Public Health COVID-19 Working Group. Dr. Pollack, thanks for your time today. Glad to have you back on Insight.
Thanks, Beth. Nice to be back.
So the governor said we're not even out of the first wave of this pandemic. Will we actually get out of that wave, or is it possible that we could roll right into another peak at some point this year?
Yeah, it's a little hard to define where a pandemic starts. We had that problem with the WHO being quite delayed, and likewise where it stops. But I think the governor was very conservative in kind of painting a picture of where we're at right now, which is we've got a major pandemic going on, and while the numbers may be changing directions in a favorable way, we're not out of the woods, as you said. And we do have active cases and new cases diagnosed every day. We still have deaths. The death rate has gone down a bit, but it's gone down quite a bit in some places, but we still have the disease out there. So we're worried about this. And it's also very clear now with a month and a half, 2 months worth of experience that the social distancing measures that went into place definitely bent the curve for California and other areas of the country, really majorly impacted what it could have looked like here. And so obviously some of these measures have had a big impact. And that's why it's important that we make sure that we're doing things safely. And when we reopen, we do it in a safe manner.
Are you expecting a spike of cases in June? And if so, how significant might that be?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, one of the issues is, and it's difficult to balance this out, but we saw over the Memorial Day weekend that there were folks that were congregating and kind of violating best public health safe practices. At the Capitol Park, we had people that were very close to each other and not masking up. We've had pictures of some recreational areas, beaches and the rivers, where people seem to be very close on top of each other. It's hard to sort of quantitate, though, the magnitude of sort of violating those principles of physical distancing. So it's hard to say, but obviously that presents a situation where you can have increased number of new cases. And we've seen this in South Korea, where they had really good control. There was one person who came over, a super spreader who traveled, came and hit five nightclubs in one night, and I think there were 84 cases diagnosed. So that's why it's hard to predict whether we'll have, you know, more spikes coming down the line. It's very possible we will. And if you look at this as Memorial Day as being a sentinel point, perhaps, for people doing things they shouldn't, it's pretty clear that by Father's Day, we would see sort of increase in some of the occurrence of the disease. And again, one of the problems we have is that the occurrence is very difficult to pick up from just testing, because as you know, the availability of testing has grown dramatically. As you pointed out, the governor reported that we had 50,000 tests done daily, I think, in the last full day of counting. So the problem is that we have a moving target in terms of who's being tested. So the number of positive cases and the positive case rate is going to continue to change as we have more testing going on. So that's not a really good indicator. Unfortunately, one of the major indicators that we have is mortality, you know, COVID-related mortality, which is a little bit more stable. And so we look very carefully at the death number of deaths that are occurring and the death rates, as well as number of hospitalizations, which have been consistently falling. If we see that starting to turn around and move in the wrong direction, you know, we're going to be worried about, more disease coming down the line.
I do want to spend some time on testing, but let me get back to a couple points you made. I noticed the phrase super spreader. Have there been identified super spreaders in the United States anywhere, a one-person point of contact for multiple transmissions?
I don't know. I haven't really followed that carefully. I know that there have been certain groups, some church groups, for example, where there was a case and close contact. And it's hard to say that they're super spreaders. It could be just a normal spreader, but with people that are in confined physical location where they can effectively transmit because they're not keeping that safe distancing. So it's hard to say. And the term super spreader.
What does super spreader mean? Is that indicative of the person's behavior in transmission?
Well, we can't separate that out. It could mean two things. It could be their behavior. It could also be that they happen to very effectively shed the virus. In other words, they're replicating the virus, and they shed it very effectively. And, of course, there's this issue, too, of people that are asymptomatic, folks that don't know they're infected, have no symptoms that they recognize that are infected and are able to spread it to people. And we don't know yet whether there are individuals that just have a lot more capacity to physically replicate the virus and spread it to other folks. We can't separate that out from the behavior aspect where people are in close quarters and not doing what they should be doing. So it's still a theoretical construct, but biologically it's certainly clear that there'd be a range of people that are able to spread the virus for longer periods of time and perhaps even more viral particles. We don't have that information yet.
All right. South Korea just reported a spike in the last day or so, its biggest daily spike in almost 50 days. So South Korea is definitely a country to keep an eye on. Why aren't people, scientists in particular, health leaders, being more specific about what's believed to roll through the United States or California in terms of cases around Father's Day weekend based on Memorial Day? Why is there such kind of caution about this? Does that speak to so much being unknown about transmission, a lower level of disease than believed, the warm weather? What do you think is going on?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of all those factors. I mean, we don't really know who's infected. We just don't know in the population. And, you know, just think about this. If we're doing 50,000 tests a day, there's 40 million people in California. If you test somebody on one day and they're negative, and let's say they're really negative, it's a true negative, you know, the next day they can get infected.
Exactly.
And if they're not being retested again. So we don't know. We just don't know the level of the disease in the population. We don't know how much of that's being transmitted. We just don't have that. And it may be very difficult, if not impossible, to ever get that because we're not going to test everybody every day. That's impractical. If we could do that, which, again, is not possible, we would have a very good idea of what's going on. And then we could start looking at attribution to different things like the social gathering, people in confined spaces. But we just don't have that information. So we're kind of looking at just the tip of the iceberg all the time and trying to model what the rest of the iceberg looks like based on, you know, sort of partial bits of data here and there.
I'm talking with Dr. Brad Pollack. He is a public health leader from UC Davis and chairman of the UC Systems Public Health COVID-19 Working Group. In fact, you're not in favor of massive testing, and you don't think that's our pathway out of this pandemic, do you?
That's correct. I don't think so. I think when we talk about massive general testing, you know, it's been something easy to grab onto, and I think there is this belief, and it's partially true, that the more testing is good because you can identify more cases, and you can get in there and sort of identify cases and do contact tracing and look at people that were exposed. But the problem, again, is just a massive population. When you try to apply this to the whole state of California with 40 million people, you're just looking at a little tiny fraction on any one day. And again, there's the chance of people being infected the day after they had a negative test. So this massive general testing, I don't think is really practical. I think instead, there's a very strong belief that in terms of testing, that it should be targeted. And we already know this, you know, at a very minimal level, we understand that testing people that have been identified as being symptomatic, you know, clearly they need to be tested. They have a higher likelihood of actually having the virus. People that are living in very confined spaces, and this would be a lot of the senior living facilities, folks in prisons, for example, in these very confined situations, that doing testing applied there is going to be much more effective. And of course, testing people that have repeated contacts with folks that might be infected. This includes first responders, people that work in mass transit, grocery store employees, for example, and of course, our healthcare workers, which are on the front lines. I mean, these folks make sense to be doing targeted testing with. Those are some of those examples there. And of course, anybody who's hospitalized or having medical procedures done, that's going to be important in order to protect the patients as well as the healthcare workers. So this kind of targeting is going to be much more effective than just doing massive testing. But you know, I understand where the sentiment comes from. And again, massive to the extreme where you do the entire population every day, that would be perfect. But it just, that's not going to be possible, obviously.
So you might feel that I'm being repetitive with this question, but I want to get this very succinctly from you. What to you would be a wise testing strategy in the state of California right now?
Well, I think, again, it's to do more targeting, that is identifying groups. And it's not just based on occupation, for example. It may be very important to target geographic areas that may reflect. We know that communities of color, they present that there's more vulnerability for having severe consequences of the disease. So it would make sense to target certain communities defined by geography and also by sociodemographic composition that are at higher risk for having the bad effects of the infection. So that would make sense. And as I mentioned, some of the individuals and people living in confined situations there. I mean, one of the things we have right now is that UC Davis and Sacramento County struck a deal for us to go in and test all the nursing homes in Sacramento County with the support of Dr. Bielenson. And I think we're having a little bit of an uptake issue. We're not getting folks sort of doing it at the rate that we had expected. And I think, again, if you were to target all of the nursing homes, assisted living facilities in Sacramento County, the effect of that kind of targeted testing is clearly going to have a bigger impact on mortality than just doing, you know, general testing, setting up a place over at Cal Expo, and anybody who, you know, of course, there was screening that was going on for that for symptomatic cases at the beginning, but doing this general population testing where a person gets one test, that may be it. And again, it doesn't really tell you about the risk. Whereas going into a nursing home, for example, and testing everybody and having, again, repeated testing to ensure that you're going to catch any new cases that spread like wildfire in those confined spaces, that makes a lot more sense to me.
Would you clarify what you think the holdup might be with the nursing home testing? Why it isn't, I think you used the word uptake, why it isn't moving along as either quickly or efficiently as it could be?
I don't know right now. I actually just heard that this was a little bit of an issue. So I can't speculate on the reasons why. I just think that, again, targeting those kinds of populations just makes a lot more sense. But I don't know whether, I don't think it's logistical issues. And I know that we have the testing capacity, but there may be some other issues I'm just not aware of, pragmatic issues. So it has to be easy to do testing also. And one of the other issues, I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but obviously doing this nasopharyngeal swabbing here, which, you know, is okay to do. It's an invasive procedure and people don't like it. They're uncomfortable with it. And obviously, newer testing technologies, you know, there's been a big focus in the last few weeks on saliva testing, which is non-invasive, easier to get to. And there's even some issues now looking at breath testing, looking at exhaling breath, which has concentrations of metabolites that may represent some of the viral action. There's some work going on right now, new work, to look at breath tests that may be a better substitute for picking up viral RNA than what we're seeing right now with the nasopharyngeal swabbing. So part of it is a pragmatic issue And I know, for example, many of the University of California campuses now are trying to set up, procedures for possible return of students in the fall. And there have been different scenarios about doing testing. And so making testing very easy, non-invasive, inexpensive, will help a lot. That's a barrier to doing more testing, we think. But I'm not sure what's going on specifically with Sacramento County right now in the nursing homes. But again, I think that the general gist of trying to target high-risk populations or those that are particularly vulnerable makes a little bit more sense than just the massive testing. But, you know, we'll have to see. I mean, I think the governor had a target of having 60,000 people a day being able to be tested, but still think about 40 million people in California. And, you know, that's more than a year to try and go through one test per person.
He was saying 60 to 80,000. Okay, about the return of students in the fall, can you get as specific as possible about that? There are so many graduates, so much transition, so much unexpected definition of what the fall will be. What's the UC's position with that right now?
Well, that's actually being discussed even this morning. There's a new task force that was set up that will have most of their work done in the next week or so. That's looking at testing and contact tracing on the campuses. Testing is one of those modalities that's a consideration for whether or not it would be safe for the students to return. It's just one of those. I mean, the other issues that we're struggling with now are how do we set up the appropriate physical distancing of classrooms? How about dorms? You know, we've got multiple students living in a dorm room often, and so that's not necessarily good. So there's a lot going on right now. As you're well aware, the Cal State University system made a decision at a system level to have remote instruction for the majority of their education for the fall.
Right.
University of California is not doing that. And in fact, you know, this is, I say this, all politics are local. Well, the same thing is true for decisions being made at each of the 10 campuses. We actually have different county jurisdictions, and part of the issue about people returning in groups is going to be dictated by both the county health departments as well as the state Department of Public Health. So those are going to be important. And so right now the UC system is still trying to formulate guidance for the campuses to use in terms of how we return to campuses safely. That's one of the things that the committee that I'm chairing is working on right now. And that's in addition to testing and contact tracing, which is, again, one part of that answer. So we don't know yet what will happen. We are trying to work hard at UC Davis, for example. We have a specific committee working on instruction. In particular, Dr. Ralph Hexter, our provost and executive vice chancellor, is chairing that committee. And we're working very hard now to see how we can do this. And then there may be different ways of opening up where you don't have all the students back. There may be subsets of the students where they really need to be on campus for finishing up things like studios and labs for their degree programs, where they have a greater need to be there physically. And so we don't know yet. We're trying to develop some contingencies. And, of course, it all depends on what happens with the epidemic. If there's a major spike, we're seeing a lot of cases, you know, before the fall, that may influence, you know, how quickly we try to return to our normal.
So I heard a couple things in that. Number one, there could be a hybrid return to school in the fall with some students still distance learning and others on campus at the UC campuses. That's one thing I heard. The other is that the different county rules will dictate what can happen on different campuses. So there can't just be a one policy fits all UC plan.
That's right. Well, they could be, theoretically, because the Cal State University did that, but UC is taking a different tact here, and I think that's very important. We have, most of the campuses have very close relationships with our county health officers, and in many cases, we have a lot of our students, and with those that have public health programs, a lot of our students work and do practicums in the county health departments, and so it does make sense to be working closely with them, but again, we're trying to take a more flexible way of thinking about this, and again, having contingencies where, you know, the carpet could be pulled out from underneath us, you know, at the last minute. So we need to be able to accommodate that. The other thing I'll just say about instruction is, well, you know, this remote instruction thing doesn't sound as much fun as being in a classroom. I've been teaching a course, a 3-hour-a-week course this quarter that was going to be in person, and it went to remote instruction at the spring break. And You know, I wouldn't say that all of our courses are equal, but I think most of us have been surprised at how effective it can be doing remote instruction with, you know, synchronous Zoom-type sessions here. It's worked very well. It's not a substitute for being in a classroom physically together, but in some cases, it may be a little bit better for certain types of things that you're trying to do. But, you know, I know that we are working as hard as we did before we had the stay-at-home rules in place to provide really high-quality education. And I'm not doing any less work now. I'm interacting with my students. It just happens to be over Zoom with you know, two-way video and so on. And so I think that, you know, it's not the same. And I know my nephew is going to be starting San Luis Obispo, he's supposed to start in the fall, and he's very disappointed. He lives in Santa Cruz, very disappointed he's not going to be physically going there, and I understand that disappointment, because there's more to being a university student than just classes. There's student life and everything else.
Right.
Disappointing, but I do think that most of us are very amazed at what we've learned that we can do with remote instruction, and it's gotten much better, even in the last 2 months. So, and I think the wave of the future, if you look out 25 years in the future, you know, you'll be taking your astronomy course from the latest Carl Sagan superstar remotely instead of whoever's locally available to you. So I think you'll see instruction change anyway as we do more virtual reality. There's a lot of other ways of learning that we need to be more flexible about. And I think, of course, the idea is to sort of leverage those methods in a way that's going to be stronger than the sum of the parts. I mean, I think that using all of these modalities, including in-person and laboratory experience, along with some of the remote learning, I think can be very, very powerful and maybe the wave of the future.
All right, Dr. Pollack, thanks for this ongoing conversation that we seem to have every few weeks. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to more decisions then, it sounds, relatively soon from the UC system overall. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure, Beth. Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
That's Dr. Brad Pollack, chair of the UC System's Public Health COVID-19 Working Group. He is also a professor, department chair, and associate dean for public health sciences at UC Davis School of Medicine. Up next, hair salons and barbershops with the green light to open in 47 of California's 58 counties with changes. We'll talk more about that. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio.